Portland State University's Queer Awareness Week 2006 began yesterday and runs all week long. Its theme is Show Your True Colors and featured live acts of homosexuality. The event will feature entertainment, educational workshops, a queer art gallery, and a community resource fair. It will include a speech by City Commissioner Sam Adams and be the debut of the Pink Gallery at the PSU Queer Resource Center. The event will include a performance by Sissy Boy, which will be followed by a Lube Olympics and Drag Race. The week culminates with Queer Prom 2006, a night of kings and queens. The event is on Friday, May 12th, and runs from 8 p.m. until midnight in Portland State University's Hoffman Hall, which is located at 1833 Southwest 11th Avenue. The night's festivities will feature gender-bending performances by members of DK, PDK, Sissy Boy, and Uber Gay Cabaret. Sounds being provided by DJ Jimmy Jamma and DJ Puppet. A bar will be open to patrons ages 21 and up. Admission for the event is $5. To learn more about Queer Awareness Week 2006 and for a full schedule of events, please contact the PSU Queer Resource Center by calling 503-725-9742 or send an email to qrc@pdx.edu.
Dinner time can always be an adventure at the Cheney House, but those are always private discussions.
I am a former Assemblies of God leader in Australia. I used to preach all the mega churches around Australia. But, of course, during that time, I was actually a gay man fighting my homosexuality.
It's photographs of queer men at home, sort of engaged in everyday life. And it's a mixture of everyday individuals with interesting stories in one way or another, and leaders within the community as well.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Pride tensions mount in Moscow as Krakow's is attacked, a Pentecostal preacher unlearns closet conditioning, and an award-winning photographer captures New York City gay men where they live. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Charles Hall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 6th, 2006. It's getting tense in Moscow in the days leading up to that city's first ever Pride March, scheduled to take place on May 27th, the anniversary of the 1993 abolition of Soviet-era laws in Russia against male homosexuality. Moscow Mayor Yuri Lushkov has condemned the event and refused to issue a permit for it, and several of the city's religious leaders have warned of violent attacks against participants if the Pride March goes forward. Activists charge that the ongoing anti-queer rhetoric fueled successive nights of ugly attacks this week outside two gay venues. An unruly demonstration forced the closing of a large party that more than 1,000 gay men and lesbians were expected to attend. Many demonstrators pelted people leaving the party with eggs and fruit, and police had to escort some partygoers to safety. On the following night, about 100 demonstrators shouting anti-gay slogans and smashing car windows tried to prevent people from entering Moscow's best-known gay club. According to the BBC, anti-gay protesters on both nights were an odd mix of young men from a Russian nationalist group and elderly Orthodox Christians.
The Pride March in Krakow, Poland, on April 28th, was violently attacked by members of the right-wing All Poland Youth Group. The BBC reports that counter-demonstrators threw rocks and eggs and chased after the marchers even when they left the planned route. Police with riot shields and clubs finally intervened, arresting several counter-protesters. More than 1,000 LGBT people and their supporters took part in the march. There's been a sharp increase in overt homophobia in Poland since the conservative Law and Justice Party came to power last year, including anti-gay statements by President Lech Kaczynski, who's reportedly called gays perverts, his brother and party leader Jarosław Kaczynski, and Prime Minister Kazimierz Marcinkiewicz, who said that if anyone tries to infect others with their homosexuality, then the state must intervene with this violation of freedom.
Anti-gay killings continue, apparently unabated, in Iraq. The latest victim was a teenage boy who reportedly may not have even been gay, but had sex with other men for money to support his impoverished family. Ali Hili, an exiled gay Iraqi with the London-based queer human rights group Outrage, said that a neighbor witnessed the execution, reporting that 14-year-old Ahmed Khalil was dragged from his home in the Al-Dura area of Baghdad by four uniformed Iraqi police officers who shot him twice in the head and then several more times in the body. An anti-gay edict issued by the powerful Shiite Muslim leader Ali Sistani in October has unleashed what amounts to a pogrom against gays and lesbians who are reportedly being murdered virtually every week. Human rights groups have called on the Bush administration to do something to stop the killings, but there's yet to be any public response by U.S. government officials.
A 25-year-old newspaper vendor pleaded guilty in Jamaica this week to the vicious murder in June 2004 of Brian Williamson, founder of the Jamaica Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals, and Gays, or JFLAG. Dwight Hayden told authorities that he and a friend, known only as Bombhead, killed Williamson after he refused their demands for money. But human rights groups have called it a hate crime. Williamson was hacked to death, stabbed more than 70 times by the two men. Hayden will be sentenced later this month for murder and robbery with aggravation. Bombhead is still being sought by authorities in connection with the crime.
Cameroon's government has refused to release nine men jailed on charges of homosexuality despite their acquittal in court last month, according to the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC. The men have been jailed since being caught up in a raid at a gay nightclub in the capital city of Yaoundé in May last year. They'd been accused of committing homosexual acts punishable by up to 5 years in prison in Cameroon. At their trial, no witnesses were called and no proof was offered by the prosecution, so the magistrate overseeing the case declared the men innocent of all charges. They expected to be freed quickly thereafter, but the prosecutor's office has refused to order their release and has said that the men will be retried. Duga Titanji, the men's attorney in Cameroon, told IGLHRC that this development constitutes a major violation of due process. With no new arrest warrant being served, this is now a blatant case of arbitrary detention. Carrie Allen Johnson, IGLHRC's senior coordinator for Africa, said his group will work with Cameroonian activists to confront this brazen abuse in the courts and at the national and international diplomatic levels.
The Buenos Aires gay bar Zero Consequence was raided by Argentina's federal police late last month while it was hosting a private party. According to the group CHA, Argentine Homosexual Community, police turned on the lights, stopped the music, and forced the 120 partygoers to stand with their hands against the wall for an hour while information from the individual's identity cards was recorded in a notebook. It was like the worst times of the military dictatorship 30 years ago, said CHA President Cesar Sigliuti. The police occupation continued for nearly 4 hours, but no one was arrested. Some journalists speculated that the club might have failed to pay routine bribes. According to reporter Mariano Lago, the fact that it was a gay bar only made it worse, as military and police forces are deeply homophobic. Anyway, what happened was absolutely illegal. These people were taken hostage, he said. CHA announced that it plans to file criminal charges alleging illegal deprivation of freedom, meet with the Interior Ministry, and lodge a complaint of police violence with the Secretary of Human Rights.
Amid the current national debate in the U.S. over immigration policy, the groups Human Rights Watch and Immigration Equality issued a report this week on the problems faced by thousands of American citizens and their foreign-born same-gender partners, titled Family Unvalued, Discrimination, Denial, and the Fate of Binational Same-Sex Couples Under U.S. Law. The 191-page report includes testimony by gays and lesbians describing abuse and harassment by immigration officials, being deported and separated from their partners, and enduring financial as well as emotional hardships. The report details how current exclusionary policies in the U.S. are rooted in a long history of anti-immigrant sentiment and how homophobia has contributed to those policies. From the McCarthy era until as recently as 1990, U.S. law barred foreign-born lesbians and gay men from even entering the country. According to the report, many U.S. citizens are being forced to move with their foreign-born partners to countries where their relationships are recognized. At least 19 nations worldwide, Canada, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Iceland, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, Brazil, Israel, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand provide some form of immigration equality to the same-gender partners of citizens and permanent residents. A bill called the Uniting American Families Act has been introduced in both the U.S. House and Senate, but, says Scott Long of Human Rights Watch and co-author of the report, I don't think it's going to happen in this Congress.
And finally,
good evening and welcome to Prime Time. I'm Diane Sawyer.
U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney's openly lesbian daughter, Mary, finally broke her public silence this week as the Bush administration enters its sixth year. It's likely no coincidence that she's got a new book coming out called Now It's My Turn. Mary Cheney has been damned by right-wing Republicans for being an out lesbian and condemned by queer activists who've demanded that she be more vocal in the fight for LGBT civil rights. She was clearly her father's daughter doing an interview with Diane Sawyer on ABC TV's Primetime this week. Evasive at times, but painting a loving family portrait. On coming out to her parents,
it never even crossed my mind as a possibility
that
my parents wouldn't just love me. And I am incredibly lucky for that.
Is it difficult for Cheney when her father and the Republican Party take public positions against lesbi-gay equality?
Yes, and we discuss and debate them. Dinner time can always be an adventure at the Cheney house. But those are always private discussions.
If your dad were not vice president, would you be in this party?
I don't tend to like hypothetical questions.
She did say she opposes the so-called federal marriage amendment, that she'd like to see the U.S. military's don't ask, don't tell policy repealed, and that she supports adoptions by same-gender couples. Would she marry Heather Poe, her partner of 14 years, if she could?
From my perspective, Heather and I already are married. We have built a home and a life together. I hope I get to spend the rest of my life with her. The way I look at it is we're just waiting for state and federal law to catch up with us.
Mary Cheney nevertheless remains in lockstep with the administration of her dad's boss, George W. Bush, whom she describes as a good man. And while her new book is called Now It's My Turn, might it just be the prequel to a less restrictive future, or will she forever be her father's daughter? As Diane Sawyer notes, Dick Cheney will be
vice president for another 2.5 years until finally Mary Cheney's conflict between supporting her dad and standing up for herself will be over.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 6, 2006, written this week by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Charles Hall.
And I'm John Beaupre.
What would it be like to kick back in their living rooms with Edward Albee, John Waters, or Junior Vasquez? We'll find out later in the program. In 1991, Anthony Van Brown fell in love with a man. Not a terribly unusual thing at the time, unless you happened to be a leader in Australia's Pentecostal Assemblies of God Church. So Van Brown had some difficult choices to make, charted in his award-winning 2004 autobiography, A Life of Unlearning, Coming Out of the Church, One Man's Struggle. The book opened a floodgate of letters from people around the world who related to his story, and he continues to offer comfort to those struggling with conflicts of faith and sexuality. This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay talks with Anthony Van Brown at his home in Sydney, Australia.
Well, I am a former Assemblies of God leader in Australia. I'm one of the prominent preachers, and used to preach all the mega churches around Australia, such as Hillsong. Started the largest youth organisation in New South Wales, which is Youth Alive, now with tens of thousands of young people in it. But of course, during that time, when I was very well connected as a preacher, that I was actually a gay man fighting my homosexuality.
What was going on for you during that time?
Well, I lived with the belief, as many people do within those circles, that it was unacceptable for me to be homosexual, unacceptable to God, certainly, and to others. So I spent 22 years going through ex-gay programs, exorcisms, 40-day fasts, and 16 years of marriage to try and change my sexual orientation.
Were you a practicing homosexual at that time?
I was struggling with it daily. And most of the time I could win those battles, but not all times. And it was during one of those encounters that I actually was forced to face the toughest decision of my life.
What was that?
Well, I met a guy in Brisbane in Queensland, Australia, and what happened was I think it was the first intimate moment that I'd ever had with a man, and that touched me very deeply, and I knew then that it was not really about the sex but about the love, and I fell in love.
So you've written an autobiography that's actually been touching quite a lot of people worldwide. What sort of responses have you been getting from people because of your book?
Look, the response, Barry, has been overwhelming because I've had emails from such a variety of people. But the common theme is they're all saying, your story is my story. And they talk to me about the conflict that their faith and their sexuality has caused them, to the point where some have suffered some psychological damage or deep emotional trauma. Some have even attempted suicide, or some actually have suicided. We've lost 3 guys in one church in the space of 2 years, which was very tragic. And so people have tried to get married, and pastors have told them this would solve their problem. So we have such a variety of people, and the consequences that they've experienced because of this conflict between their faith and their sexuality. It's been overwhelming.
What are you doing now to help these people?
Well, several things, Barry. It's been exciting to see that we've actually started a global network now, which is an online community, but we also have meetings, or we call them get-togethers, which is great. It's very informal, a very safe space for people to come and share with people and talk about their experiences that other people would understand. But our online community is Freedom to Be, and there people are able to share their stories. We have resources for them if they will look at the theological basis, or look at it from a clinical or biological or psychological basis. All the information's there, and they can chat with other people.
Now, I understand that you're still in touch with the Assemblies of God leadership here in Australia.
I think that I've got such a privileged position, Barry, because most of the men who are on the National Executive of the Assemblies of God in Australia were my closest personal friends in the ministry, and here they are now in the leadership. And, you know, what I would love to create is a very respectful and intelligent dialogue around the issue of sexual orientation. The most powerful thing that I have to offer is my integrity and who I am as a person, that I'm not an angry activist, you know, who's there wanting to fight. I'm wanting to call people to the table to sit down and talk in an intelligent way. And so by me maintaining some relationship and contact with these people, even though there might be a difference of opinion and a belief, we can actually have some respect for each other and start to move things forward.
Have you been seeing any progress there yet?
I have already, yes. There have been people that have written to me that have said, actually, I have totally turned around my belief system now through being in contact with you over the last 6 months.
So what are your future plans now?
Well, there is another book on the way, which I've been considering writing, especially talking about some other stories that have come through from the responses from my readers, and also reaching out globally. I've got a number of contacts now in the US of other churches there, which are Pentecostal churches, which are affirming, which is miraculous. Anyone who's been involved in those circles will know that's an amazing step forward. We're waiting for that to happen here in Australia. There will be the first church. We're not sure who it is yet, but it will happen. And so we are going to gather strength in numbers because we are now able to connect through the internet. And so that's what we're doing now.
Are you still a practicing Pentecostal?
Look, I go along to Hillsong Church on a regular basis. I have a very, very strong faith. What's actually happened, I guess, is all the garbage that previously existed in my belief system through what I've been through is totally washed away now. It got washed away with the big explosion that happened in my life. So that now I have, I think, a very strong and what we would say would be the essence of faith and relationship with God.
How can you reconcile Pentecostal doctrine with homosexuality?
Current Pentecostal doctrine? is not reconciled with homosexuality. But what we need to do, if we're going to look at this theologically, we actually have to look at it from a perspective of the culture of the day, the historical context of these verses which are used against homosexuality, and to go back in the original language. And when things are looked at from that aspect as opposed to a literal translation, you get a whole different understanding perspective on what those verses mean.
How can people get in touch with you?
Look, they could do it through the Freedom to Be website, which will be freedom2b.org. So that's freedom2b.org.
Anthony sees a bright future ahead for gays and lesbians in the church.
Change is happening. And all the polls tell us, every time they come out, a survey, is that there is this gradual shift within the community. The more people get to know who we are, the preconceived ideas and the misconceptions can drop away, and we can start to learn to embrace difference and have tolerance and acceptance.
Do you think the church is changing its views on accepting gays?
Some corners of the church are. Others are fighting it tooth and nail, but they're fighting a losing battle. There's been three challenges to the church. The first challenge was around slavery. The second challenge has been around the role of women and equality of women. Now the church is facing this third challenge, which is about gay and lesbian people and acceptance.
Anthony's book is called A Life of Unlearning, and you can download the first chapter for free from his website, www.anthonyvenbrown.com. For This Way Out, I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia.
Hi, this is Carleen.
And I'm Gareth.
And we're from JFLAG,
Jamaica Forum for Lesbians, Homosexuals and Gays.
And you're listening to This Way Out,
the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
Award-winning photographer Tom Atwood's pictures exploring the lives of gay icons and iconoclasts are definitely worth more than a few thousand words. He's collected them in a new book entitled Kings in Their Castles, Photographs of Queer Men at Home. This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with Tom Atwood about the book, the queer men he chose, and their castles.
There are a lot of gay male photography books, many featuring gay men in the nude. Surprisingly, one of the most intimate books features men that are fully clothed. Tom Atwood's Kings in Their Castles, Photographs of Queer Men at Home is a collective portrait of gay urban artists, writers, musicians, and designers in their New York City homes.
Most of the subjects are New Yorkers, and I lived in New York the whole time that I was photographing the book. It's photographs of queer men at home, sort of engaged in everyday life, and it's a mixture of everyday individuals with interesting stories in one way or another, and leaders within the community as well. So there's some public figures, some filmmakers like John Waters, Joel Schumacher, some designers like Todd Oldham, John Bartlett, some writers like Edward Albee, Michael Cunningham, Edmund White. So it's a bit of a who's who of the gay community as well.
And what inspired this project?
I felt like there hadn't been really a serious photo documentary of the gay male community that I had seen anyways, and I certainly hadn't seen any featuring men at home. Most of the books that you see in Barnes & Noble or A Different Light have nudes romping through the forest or lounging on the beach or that sort of thing, and I kind of wanted to offer a different perspective, and I kind of try to seek out subjects that sing to me, and I think that gay men have a real flair for design and live in some of the most interesting living spaces in the country. So from an aesthetic point of view, I felt like the subject matter was fascinating. And then I also sort of felt like there's a breed of men, possibly older men, that were around during the 60s and 70s, kind of urban bohemians, beatniks, mavericks, iconoclasts, who seem to be sort of slowly disappearing. So I think with greater assimilation into mainstream, which is clearly a desired shift, there's kind of been a little bit of a loss of that element of society, and I kind of wanted to document it.
Can you elaborate on your own artistic style and sensibility, and what makes your approach unique, different?
I attempt to distinguish this book from other photography series in a number of ways. I kind of seek out apartments with wall-to-wall stuff that are just packed with paraphernalia and detail, and I'm kind of attempting to say what all this stuff says about the subjects and their personality. And I use a really wide depth of field to include both the person and their apartment and all the stuff in their apartment to sort of suggest that they're a unified fabric, whereas I think traditional portraiture tends to focus on the person and choose backgrounds of streamlined simplicity. But in my photos, you know, neither really predominates. There's kind of a balance between the two. And then in terms of composition, I often include both the floor and the ceiling, kind of embracing as much of the environment as possible. And I kind of want to challenge people's eyes by throwing as much into the frame of the camera as possible.
How did you pick your subjects, and did you have any knowledge of what their home would look like?
I would often show up not having seen any pictures, maybe having had a brief description of their space. So I would have to work very quickly.
What about John Waters?
John Waters was wonderful. His space was one where it really reflected his personality and kind of what I would have expected. When I arrived, he took a photograph of me with a Polaroid and tacked it on the wall along with hundreds of others. I guess he takes photos of everybody that visits his place. And his living room was actually kind of formal. He had an oriental carpet and some antiques and some old paintings and that kind of thing. But then, you know, he had all this quirky stuff. He had an execution chair in his hallway. He had fake food throughout his whole apartment. And I wanted to do something theatrical with him being a filmmaker. So I asked him if I could gather the fake food from all around the apartment and throw it into a suitcase as if he was packing food into a suitcase. And he said, sure, as long as you remember where everything came from and put it all back in the right spot. And I hope I did. I never asked him. But he also just had all these other interesting things. In his attic, he had props from his movies, and then off in the corner of the attic, there was an art installation as if a terrorist were manufacturing anthrax. So there were little plastic bags with white powder. And it was all set up as if somebody was right in the middle of doing something and had just stepped away for a minute. One of the key themes of the book is that these spaces are sort of like a reflection of people's personalities, so kind of like a metaphysical extension of themselves. And I think most often people's spaces pretty accurately reflect themselves. We talked about John Waters and his space. Junior Vasquez was another person whose space was really similar to him. There was just music everywhere. He had piles of records everywhere. Todd Oldham was another one. His place was full of colors and stripes and items from his line in Target. But other times I felt like people were sort of creating fantasy worlds that allowed them to sort of blossom or be who they wanted to be, regardless of whether, you know, society might disapprove. So I think a lot of us go through great lengths to show that we're different, and I think some of us use design of our homes to communicate this, you know, unusual color palettes, foreign doorknobs, or provocative pieces of art, that sort of thing. I think a lot of these design tactics, whether consciously or not, are often used to show that we're unique. And there are loads of examples of that in the book. Thomas Lanigan Schmidt is one guy who had painted his entire space. He lived in a tenement building in New York, and he just had all these quirky things everywhere. And then other times I felt like people's spaces were sort of the opposite of them and what I would have expected.
Not everybody in the book is fabulously wealthy. Did you pick up any cool budget decorating tips going into all these people's homes that you rushed home and had to replicate? Or,
you know, I'd say New York, along with other large cities with high population density, do tend to have a lot of people that are forced to be creative about how they decorate their spaces. The spaces that I thought were most interesting from a design point of view often were spaces where the people had sort of slowly decorated it over time in kind of a piecemeal fashion and had just brought in objects from their life or objects that they had found at a flea market that meant something to them or that were interesting to them in one way or another. And there are a lot of spaces like this in my book that are really eclectic, that are just sort of reflections of the person and their interest and their personalities.
This has been a conversation with photographer and author Tom Atwood. For more information on Tom or his book, Kings in Their Castle, Photographs of Queer Men at Home, visit his website at tomatwood.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Charles Hall, Rex Wachner, Graham Underhill, Barry McKay, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on planetout.com. There's also a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please visit thiswayout.org to see some good and not so good news about This Way Out and how you can help keep this program on the air. You can also own some special LGBT history, music, and culture CDs as our thanks. That's thiswayout.org. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KPOV Bend, Oregon, CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, WHYS Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We're all gonna stay tuned.
This KBO program has been made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.